I'm going to read from verse 16 of Romans 1 through to the end of the chapter. As you will see, it's a chapter which is in some ways not palatable, but it's important. Romans 1, verse 16. I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes, first for the Jew, then for the Gentile. For in the gospel a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men, who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. Therefore God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator who is forever praised. Amen. And because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts. Even their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural ones. In the same way, the men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men committed indecent acts with other men and received in themselves the due penalty for their perversion. Furthermore, since they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, he gave them over to a depraved mind, to do what ought not to be done. They have become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. They are gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. They are senseless, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Although they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do these very things, but also approve of those who practice them. It was Sir Thomas More, the 16th century scholar, who invented the word. It was the title of a book he wrote in 1516. Utopia, he called it. In the wake of our recent Stirling crisis, critics of the Maastricht Treaty would do well to reread Utopia. They will find plenty in its pages to encourage them in their Euroscepticism. Part one of the book is a stinging denunciation of the irredeemable state of European politics. And part two is a whimsical account of an island paradise which is able to sustain its idealized social conditions, principally because it is completely isolated from all external political and economic influences, including, presumably, the Bundesbank. On the other hand, Europhiles may gain comfort from reading the book too, because in the 5 centuries since it was written, it has been repeatedly hailed by political optimists as a thrilling and visionary basis for a new society characterized by harmony and peace. A Renaissance redrafting of Plato's classic treatise, The Republic. But I suspect those are closest to the author's intention, who see it not as some program for social change, but rather as a fantasy, a work of literary imagination having more in common with Gulliver's Travels than Plato. As More himself explains in his introduction to the book, the title is a pun. In Greek, the prefix "eu" is an adverb meaning good or excellent, whilst the prefix "ou" is the negative particle meaning no or not. So depending on how exactly you pronounce it, utopia, the perfect place, is also utopia, the non-existent place. Thomas More was too much of a realist, I suspect, to engage in naive optimism about the perfectibility of the human race. For him, utopia was the correct pronunciation. His book was a wistful dream, not a political blueprint. As I say, that hasn't stopped others from seizing upon his idea and designing utopian models of an ideal world that actually are intended to direct political action. By far the most important of those in recent days, of course, is Karl Marx's Classless Society. Karl Kautsky, one of Marx's disciples, went so far as to claim that Thomas More's utopia was a prophetic anticipation of Soviet communism. He said Thomas More was the true father of the Russian Revolution. Well, if so, then that pun in the title of the book has certainly proven all too appropriate, hasn't it? As far as Marxism is concerned, the late 20th century has certainly reduced utopia to utopia. As early as the Second World War, of course, honest voices on the left wing were already expressing their disillusionment. George Orwell wrote Animal Farm in 1945 with its satirical observations about Stalinist egalitarianism. All animals are equal, but some are more equal than others, he said. And Richard Crossman, a notable British socialist, was equally candid in his Fabian lectures in 1950. All the obvious things have been done which we fought for and argued about, he said. And yet, mysteriously enough, the ideal has not been achieved. We have done them. We have created the means of the good life which they all laid down and said, if you do all these things, after that, there'll be a classless society. Well, he said, there isn't. And now in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union and even in Chairman Mao's China, they are at last facing up to the same grim truth. Utopia didn't arrive. Oh, there are a few, I know, hopeful humanists still around. People who insist that mankind is getting better and better and that the future will eradicate the alienations of the past and that evolution, like some mystical force, is guaranteeing the march of progress. Some, even these days, speak of it in astrological terms. The age of Aquarius is about to dawn, they tell us. But one looks in vain around the world for compelling evidence of such utopian expectations. Can anybody seriously doubt that the New Age, which it is so trendy to talk about now, will prove as elusive as Karl Marx's Classless Society has done? Of course it will. But let's face it, utopia never arrives. The perfect world always turns out to be the non-existent world. Our political visions prove again and again to be nothing more than tantalizing mirages of what might have been. Christina Rossetti expresses it in a few lines. The hope I dreamed of was a dream, was but a dream. And now I wake, exceeding comfortless, worn and old, for a dream. Sake. Why? That's the question we asked this morning. Why does utopia never arrive? Well, the Apostle Paul, in our study passage, has an answer. He tells us why, though we may not like his explanation. Verse 18 of Romans 1. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men. I suppose there's no aspect of the Bible's account of God that is more unpalatable for the modern liberal mind than this one. Enormous effort has been expended over the years to save Christianity from the embarrassment of having to teach so offensive an idea as an angry God. Some appeal to the evolutionary theory of religious development. The idea of divine vengeance, they say, is a primitive religious concept. Which is all right till you realize that, in fact, hell is a far more innocuous place in the Old Testament than it ever is in the New Testament. Others try to drive a wedge between the teaching of Jesus and Paul. They label Paul's talk of wrath as a kind of sub-Christian hangover from his Pharisaical past. Which again is all right till you carefully study the Gospels and realize that Jesus is far more outspoken about divine judgment than ever Paul is. Still others try to argue by a kind of cunning exegesis that what Paul is talking about here is not an attribute of God's personal character, but a kind of impersonal principle of retribution that flows through the nature of things. And that sounds reassuring, till maybe you read, say, in the book of Revelation, and find Christ pictured there as a fearsome warrior who personally treads the winepress of the fury of the wrath of God, making war on sinful mankind. And there are still others who try to soften the blow with the old cliche, well, God loves the sinner, but he hates the sin. Which again sounds a convenient line of apologetic till you realize that in the Bible, sin is not some substance that adheres to our human beings and that is separable from us. Sin is the wrong direction of me, my will, my personality. It's a corruption of my nature. There isn't some innocent, separable ego that I can hive off and say, God loves that bit and hates the other. No, sin is what I am. And that's why the Bible can speak unashamedly of me as an enemy of God, as a child of wrath. Now, I think all these efforts to evade the severe prospect of an angry God are futile. The fact is, from cover to cover, the Bible witnesses to a God who is to be feared. We've seen some of that in our earlier part of our service. He is a God of judgment. And in any case, it's unnecessary to be embarrassed by such a truth about God. The only sort of God the Bible knows is a God of judgment, and that is the only sort of God, actually, who I think is in any way credible in a world like ours, where utopia never arrives. Oh, I know in many ways it would be very nice to believe God was a kindly old fellow who had never hurt a fly, and there are some people who think they're doing Christianity a service by portraying God in such terms. But experience proves that, in fact, all such well-meaning liberal souls do is to promote atheism. For these sentimental notions of God are utterly discredited in the minds of more rigorous and honest thinkers by the persistence of evil in the world. How can you believe that God is all love when there is so much suffering and misery around, asks the skeptic. And he's quite right to ask it. Of course, you can't believe in a God who is all love when you look at the world as it is. That can't be the whole truth about God. Only a dewy-eyed romantic would suggest that you could believe that was the whole truth about God. And the Bible never suggests you have to. God is not all love. That is a mischievous half-truth. God is angry, says the Apostle Paul in our passage this morning. And only on the basis of that divine wrath is it possible to give a realistic account of the mess this world of ours is in? Now, don't misunderstand me. This doesn't mean, of course, that God's anger is the kind of irrational, uncontrolled temper which our anger usually is. No, his anger is what our anger ought to be. After all, we don't really admire somebody who's never angry, do we? You'd agree with me, wouldn't you? There are times when somebody ought to be angry. The person who goes on smiling benignly when they're confronted by injustice or cruelty. You don't admire that person, do you? No, there is such a thing as righteous anger. The sort of indignation which is furious when people do wrong. And it's that kind of anger the Bible attributes to God. What's more, when we speak of a God of anger as well of love, that doesn't imply that anger and love are exactly symmetrical aspects of his divine nature. Now, God is love in an eternal sense. He always was and always will be love. Love is a never-ceasing energy that flows out of a relationship within the Godhead between the Father and the Son. God is always loving. It is an intrinsic part of the person he is. But God's anger is rather different. God's anger is a response to something that has no eternal existence within him at all. It's called into existence by the phenomenon of that which God is not, by the phenomenon of evil. And the Bible tells us it will be quenched out of existence by the destruction of evil. So it is not true to say that God is wrath in the same unqualified way that we say God is love. That's what Martin Luther meant, I think, when he said that anger is God's strange work. There is a sense in which it is alien to him. It doesn't belong to him. But it is real. The Apostle Paul insists the wrath of God is real. And it must be so, because the alternative to an angry God is a morally indifferent God. A God who can smile upon Hitler and Mother Teresa with equal approval. And such a morally indifferent deity the Bible will not endorse. No, he says, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men. The trouble with our world, then, is not lack of education or economic planning or technological progress. Still less is it the lack of mysticism and crystals and New Age nonsense. No, the problem with our world is that we are on the wrong side of God. And God is making no secret of the fact. The evidence of his divine disapproval are all around us. Notice the two things that provoke it. Godlessness and wickedness, says Paul in verse 18. If you want to distinguish those two words, so they overlap, godlessness is a word maybe that expresses our failure as religious beings, and wickedness is a word that expresses our failure as moral beings. And those two words together summarize what the Bible means by the sinfulness of the human race. We are made in God's image, but we have rejected the norms of spirituality and morality which that image demands. And the sum of Paul's argument in these verses is that there is no excuse for that. We have no excuse for our godlessness, he says, because according to verse 20, we know enough about God to worship him. And there's no excuse for our wickedness, he says, because in verse 32, we know enough about God's moral standards to obey him. Let's look then at this key issue of inexcusability more closely. First in verses 18 to 20, no excuse for our godlessness. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. We cannot plead ignorance, says Paul. The signature of God's creative artistry is inscribed upon the universe for everyone to see. Notice Paul is not speaking here merely of some empty notional idea of God's abstract existence. There's theological content to it. God's invisible qualities, he says, are there to see. What's more, Paul is not speaking here about the possibility of some sort of a philosophical natural theology based on man's unaided reason. No, God has, as an act of deliberate revelation, signed his name on the universe so that we may see his presence there. He has shown it. He has. God has made it plain to them. What's more, notice verse 19, where Paul seems to suggest, if you read the Greek anyway, that this knowledge of God is distinctively human, because he says there, what may be known about God is plain in them. That's literally what he says. Now, it's possible to translate, as our version does, plain to them, or as some commentators say, God has made it plain among them. But I suspect Paul has chosen that preposition, in them, in order to draw attention to the fact that this knowledge of God is something distinctive to us human beings because we are human. It depends upon our human nature for it to work. If you present a computer with all the facts of the universe, it would not churn out as a kind of deduction of logic. QED, there is a God. That isn't the sort of thing Paul's talking about here. It's rather the case that by virtue of our innate human relationship to God, we cannot but sense his divine personal presence in our world. The image of God in us resonates with the divine original. That's why Paul doesn't waste time formulating empirical arguments from design, as some scholars in the 19th century and 18th century tried to do. No, he says, these things are clearly seen. They belong to that category of self-evident truth, which we human beings perceive by a kind of immediate intuition, a kind of gestalt as we look around us, for which no analytical proof is possible or necessary. We just know it is so, he says. He has revealed it in us. The highly acclaimed Cambridge philosopher Wittgenstein, you know, in a remarkable passage in his Tractatus, his most famous book, which many, I think, of his humanist followers dismiss as a kind of adolescent lapse, he writes this sentence: "The sense of the world must lie outside of the world. The sense of the world must lie outside of the world." Who can deny instinctively that that is so? Cosmologists may struggle with the mathematics of the Big Bang as long as they like. The problem of origins remains a problem. It is obvious even to the most scientifically illiterate mind, the universe is not self-explanatory. It demands a reason, and that reason cannot be within it any more than an effect can be its own cause. "We know this is so," says Paul. "We know God is the reason we're looking for. If then we are ignorant of God, it is culpable ignorance. It is willful ignorance. We are without excuse." How do we achieve that resistance to the truth? Why, says Paul, we suppress it. That's what we do, verse 18. We suppress the truth by our wickedness. Literally, we hold it down. I suppose in the category of modern Freudian psychology, we might be tempted to translate that word "repress it" rather than "suppress it." Human race has deliberately pushed the knowledge of God down below the level of consciousness in order to escape its disturbing claims. But of course, you can't escape the fact of God that easily, because as we've said, our whole existence depends every second of every day upon him. The whole universe around us declares him. The very human nature we wear reflects him. So to try to ignore God is like trying to hold your breath. You know? Try and hold your breath long enough, you go red in the face. In the same way, if human beings try to suppress the self-evident knowledge of God, if they try to live in a spiritual vacuum, sooner or later they blush with shame at the attempt. Paul goes on to describe that in verse 21. "Although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles." Paul's using a past tense here, which suggests to me that he's got in mind the Bible's account of the historical fall of man, just as we read it in the early chapters of Genesis, when Adam in his pride rejected faith in God and decided to make choices independent and in defiance of God. He condemned his race, we're told in Genesis, to an irresistible degenerative process. And Genesis traces that process for us right down to the time of the flood and those verses in Genesis 6 that were read to us. Paul is summarizing that story here, observing the consequences of this repudiation of our innate knowledge of God as it's affected the human race down through history. He says, first of all, it has consequences in our mental life. Their thinking, he says, became futile, though they claimed to be wise. Of course, Paul isn't disputing here that we human beings can think and think well. He was familiar enough with Greek philosophy to recognize the intellectual heights human beings could achieve. But what he's saying here is that even at its height, such thinking is subject to emptiness and superficiality and essential foolishness. For the human mind is a tool. And no matter how skillfully you employ your mind, you can never achieve anything with it unless it has the right material to work on. So godless reason, no matter how rigorous it may be, is bankrupt because it has severed itself from the primary datum upon which all true understanding in this universe has to be based. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. You know that famous story of the three blind zoologists examining an elephant? The first took hold of the trunk and said the elephant was like a snake. The second took hold of a leg and said the elephant was like a tree. And the third grabbed his tail and said an elephant was like a rope. So, Paul says, the philosophers of the world grope vainly for the truth and make utter idiots of themselves in the process, in spite of all their pretended intelligence, because their foolish heart is darkened. They are spiritually blind to that primary datum from which all true knowledge must proceed. Their analysis may be brilliant, but it's brilliantly wrong. There are plenty of books in the university library here that are brilliantly wrong, and you will read some. Not only does this fall, this moral degeneration, affect man's mental life, though, Paul goes on to show how it affects our religious life. They exchange the glory of the immortal God for images, he says. See, this repression of the knowledge of God cannot free us from the spiritual need for God. That's intrinsic in the way we're made. We cannot run away from that anymore. We can run away from our own shadow. It's part of our nature. We are religious creatures. So inevitably, that sublimated knowledge of our Maker emerges from our unconscious. But as is so often the case with repression, it emerges in neurotic and distorted and perverted forms, nightmarish forms. What Paul calls here man and birds and animals and reptiles, idolatry, in other words. Man-made surrogates to satisfy our religious consciousness. In the ancient world, very often these were physical objects shaped by human hands. Today, more often, they are ideas and philosophies shaped by human minds. But whether the idol is concrete or abstract, material or conceptual, makes little difference. For it is still an image, you see. It's still a product of human imagination. A deification of that which has been made, rather than a submission to the Maker. As Paul says in verse 25, they exchange the truth of God for a lie, and worship and serve created things rather than the Creator. So this process of degeneration that comes with the abandonment of God flows from consequences in our mental life through consequences in our religious life. Finally, says Paul, it has consequences in our social life. Therefore, God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity, for the degrading of their bodies with one another. Verse 26, because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts. Verse 28, since they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, he gave them over to a depraved mind to do what ought not to be done. They have become filled with every kind of wickedness. Do you see that threefold phrase? God gave them over. God gave them over. God gave them over. In the Gospel of Mark, that's the word that's used for Pilate's deliverance of Jesus to the soldiers for crucifixion. It's an act of judicial alienation. Paul is saying here that we live in a God-forsaken world. That God is so angry, there is a real sense in which he has deserted us. We usually think of the wrath of God, don't we, as something stored up for a future day of judgment. And we're not wrong to think in that way, as we shall see next week in some of the verses of chapter 2. But that isn't the whole story. Paul is talking here in verse 18 about a wrath of God that is revealed. That's a present tense there. He says, the anger of God is already observable in our world. It's observable in the futility of our thinking. It's observable in the corruption of our religion. But he says, finally, it is observable in the moral degeneration of our society. To illustrate his point, Paul fastens upon a very obvious feature of the Greco-Roman world of which he was a part. Homosexuality. Notice he mentions that in verse 24 and again in verses 26 and 27. Even their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural ones. In the same way, the men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men committed indecent acts with other men and received in themselves the due penalty for their perversions. Now, this issue of homosexuality, of course, is so prominently debated today, it would just be irresponsible of me not to draw your attention to Paul's very specific allusion to it here and his moral hostility to it. It's worth saying, I think, that some in the gay Christian movement have sought to soften the attitude of the New Testament on homosexuality by claiming that its hostility is only to pederasty, that is, the sexual exploitation of young boys. If you read this passage honestly, I think you will have to admit that whilst it is certainly true that Greek society took an unbelievably tolerant attitude towards pederasty, even applauding it as superior to heterosexual love sometimes, Paul is not limiting his target in that way here. He's referring to homosexual behavior in general, both male and female. And he insists that it is all, quote, shameful, unnatural, indecent. Those are the words he uses. Now, I have to say, if I'm honest, that I find this particularly a difficult subject to deal with from the pulpit. I have known a considerable number of gay people over the years, and I've counted some of them as personal friends. And I find it extremely difficult to dismiss some of them, certainly, as abysmal specimens of moral degeneration. I've understood something of the moral struggle some of them have gone with in coming to terms with their sexual orientation. Some of them have been among the most caring and unselfish people I've ever met. And when they have asked me, as a Christian, Roy, why should God forbid us the experience of physical intimacy with a much-loved partner when he grants it to others in marriage, in the heterosexual population, I find myself uncharacteristically dumb. I have to admit to them, I do not fully understand why God says no. But then I also have to say to them that it is precisely at such moments of incomprehension that the integrity of my faith is most critically put to the test. Adam didn't understand why God prohibited access to the tree of knowledge. He got no explanation. All he knew was that the God who made him had banned the enjoyment of that particular tree by a divine thou shalt not. If he had trusted God, then that prohibition would have sufficed to silence the tempter. But he did not trust God. And he experienced the folly of his doubt. Fact is, you see, God is under no obligation to furnish us with satisfying explanations of all his commandments. He has the right to demand our obedience. He doesn't require our consent. If we are not equal to him in wisdom, we must sometimes bow to his wisdom. We surrender to the primal sin of Adam. Every time in our Promethean arrogance, we act as though we were equal to him in wisdom and demand an explanation and refuse to obey unless we have an explanation. That isn't the way it works. God says no to homosexuality because as our creator, he knows the way he designed us to behave and he expects us to trust his loving concern for our best interests. He assures us we risk irremediable wreckage of our own lives and of our world if we flout his instructions. And if we trust God, that should be enough. Having said that, though, it is important not to exaggerate or misrepresent what Paul is saying here on this subject of homosexuality. For instance, it's clear from that reference to bodies in verse 24 and to indecent acts in verse 27, that Paul's comments here relate to actual genital intercourse of a homosexual kind, not merely to the homosexual condition. Nowhere in the Bible is it suggested that gay men and women are in some special category of moral perdition. They are human beings of equal value and equal dignity. Those of us here who are gay have equal title to be here in church as anybody else. The Bible insists that if they're to obey God's will for their lives, gay people must practice celibacy. It's tough. But they are not the only people who have to come to terms with sexual frustration if they're to follow God's will for their lives. There are plenty of other single people in the world for whom sexual continence is hard. Furthermore, it's important not to misrepresent that final clause of verse 27. This is one of the places where I'm rather angry with the New International Version. Received in themselves the due penalty for their perversion. Well, I don't think that Greek word demands the translation perversion. It is the Greek word error, a much less loaded term than perversion. Translated as we have it there, it sounds as if God has some unspecified but particularly individualized punishment stored up for homosexuals. I've even heard this very text viewed as prophetic of the AIDS plague. They receive in themselves the due penalty for their perversion. That's it, AIDS. I'm quite certain that Paul had nothing of the sort in mind. That word error, I suggest to you, refers back to the general abandonment of the true God, which is true of all the human race and of which Paul has been speaking earlier. The error of the human race in giving up God, suppressing the truth of God. That's the fundamental error Paul is talking about. And as he sees it, homosexuality is a consequence of that spiritual apostasy. He puts it even more clearly in verses 25 and 26, you see. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts. Homosexuality, then, is itself the penalty he's talking about here, which a God-forsaken people receive in themselves as the result of their moral and spiritual rebellion, their error. As Paul's describing things here in Romans 1, you see, moral degeneration is the result of God's wrath, not the cause of it. The primal sin, according to Paul in Romans 1, is our repudiation of God. God himself, not his moral law. Now that's a vital insight for me, especially where this issue of homosexuality is concerned. You know, a lot of work has been done in recent years in trying to understand the causes of homosexuality, and it's pretty clear that it is a very complex picture. For some individuals, homosexuality is almost certainly merely learned behavior. Single-sex boarding schools and the Navy are particularly notorious environments where such tuition is available. Where homosexuality is learned behavior of that sort, it can probably, usually, be unlearned by behavioral therapy. For others, however, the root of their homosexual orientation seems to lie in distorted patterns of family relationship, experienced at a very young age. One sees this far too often in pastoral counseling to dismiss it all as coincidence. The classic scenario for a male homosexual is the weak, ineffectual father figure and a very dominant, emotionally suffocating mother. You could view that kind of homosexuality as a form of emotional immaturity, which perhaps, hopefully, a person might grow out of with skilled help. But there are still others, which it has to be said there is increasing evidence for this. There are some others for whom homosexuality may be a physiological condition. Recent work suggests that gender-linked behavior cannot all be put down to social conditioning. Feminists in particular have resisted this particular piece of scientific work, because they want to suggest that gender behavior is just the result of how you're brought up. But the scientific evidence is growing against that naive view. The brains of men and women are wired differently from the womb as a result of the action of certain sex hormones. There's an increasing body of evidence in support of that. And one spin-off of that is that it may well be true that the brains of heterosexuals and homosexuals are different in some way, that the roots of this are physiological in origin. One paper published only last year provided the first actual evidence of this, that the hypothalamus of the brain is dimorphic with sexual orientation. That's what it said on the heading of the paper. In simple language, that means the brains of homosexual men are different from the brains of heterosexual men. There will be strong resistance amongst evangelical Christians to that particular work. But if it is the truth, we have to face it. And it means that at least in a proportion of the homosexual population, that condition is innate and irremediable by anything short of a physical miracle. Now, none of those observations on the causes of homosexuality threaten Paul's analysis here in Romans 1, if we've understood it correctly. For Paul is not blaming homosexuals here for the manifestation of the wrath of God on the world. He's saying that homosexuality was one particularly obvious symptom, especially in the world he came from, of society's abandonment of God and by God. The spiritual power and incentive that would have enabled human beings to exercise moral self-restraint has been lost in our abandonment of God. And so we find ourselves the helpless victims of unbridled appetites and passions, what he calls in verse 26, shameful lusts. And homosexual behavior is one, and no doubt for Paul, one particularly gross expression, of those shameful lusts. But it is only one, as he goes on to make clear in verses 28 and following. They have become filled with every kind of wickedness, he says. Evil, greed, and depravity, they are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. They are gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. They are senseless, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Although they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do these very things, but they also approve of those who practice them. Now, many a person has raised an eyebrow at that last verse. Is Paul really implying there that non-participatory approval of sin is a worse crime than committing the sin itself? Is that what he means when he says they not only do such things but also approve of those who practice them? Is that his implication? I suspect it is. And I think he's right. For as we have just suggested in the case of homosexuality, in this fallen, broken world of ours, some people are morally weaker, morally disadvantaged, through no personal fault of their own. Their education, maybe, has perverted their adolescent development. They were exploited as young teenagers and now have habits that are hard for them to break. Their family life in infancy distorted their emotional makeup. They now have sexual hang-ups they cannot escape from. Their very genes may be wired up the wrong way, for the fall has not just disrupted our psyche, it has disrupted the very material of our universe. Now, of course, such people are still responsible for their actions. They are without excuse, too. But their sin, I suggest to you, is not so heinous as those who, suffering no such intrinsic weakness, endorse morally aberrant behavior and foster it in society at large. I suspect our liberal tolerance of gay behavior will incur a far more damning judgment before the bar of God than will those gays themselves whom we so patronizingly seek to affirm. What God cannot stand, what is peculiarly an evidence of his wrath, is a society which sees nothing wrong with it and brazenly parades that it sees nothing wrong with it. Gays, you see, some of them at least, may claim mitigating circumstances for their immoral conduct. We may claim no excuse at all, says Paul. So don't point the finger at others, says Paul. When it comes to the wrath of God, don't point the finger at others, least of all the homosexual population. If you're going to blame anyone, he says, blame yourself. Are there no shameful lusts in your life? No greed? No envy, no slander, no arrogance, no disobedience to parents, no callousness, no cruelty, no sexual immorality. They know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death. But they not only continue to do these things, they approve those who do them. You have no excuse. No excuse. There's that famous story of G.K. Chesterton when there was some correspondence in the Times earlier in the century about what was wrong with the world. And Chesterton, who was a Roman Catholic, got progressively more frustrated with the humanistic twaddle that was being expressed in the correspondence of the column of the Times on this subject. And finally he wrote to the editor, "Dear sir, in response to your correspondence about what's wrong with the world, I am yours sincerely, G.K. Chesterton." You want to know why utopia never arrives? I'm the reason. You are the reason. If God put us back in paradise, we would spoil it within an hour. No wonder he's angry. We have flouted his moral authority, we have ruined his beautiful world, and there is no one to blame but ourselves. And, insists Paul, we know it. Oh, we look around for excuses all the time, but deep down, at the deepest level of our personal honesty, we know we are accountable. And when we face God in judgment, it will therefore come as no surprise to us. We are already expecting it. What can you do about it? Here we are, part of a world against which the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven. A world where utopia can never arrive. What can we do about it? Is there no answer? It is Paul's great thesis in this letter to the Romans that indeed there is an answer. We shall have a lot to say about that answer in coming weeks. Suffice it this morning to say he more or less summarizes that answer in verses 16 and 17 at the very beginning of our Bible reading. Look at them again. "I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes, first for the Jew, then for the Gentile. For in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last." Do you see the parallel there? In verse 18, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men. But in verse 17, the righteousness from God is being revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last. Paul's telling us in these verses why he feels privileged to be a Christian preacher. In spite of all the hardships it brought him, he thought it was the best possible job in the world. Why? "Because this gospel of Jesus Christ," he said, "which I'm commissioned to preach, is the only hope for a human race which is perishing under the wrath of God. In this gospel, God has provided a way of salvation, a way whereby we can be righteous in his sight and escape this wrath under which by nature we find ourselves." And what is the key for the discovery of that righteousness? Faith, he says. It is by faith from first to last. Do you know how many psychiatrists it takes to change a light bulb? Only one, but the light bulb has really got to want to change. If you're going to find the righteousness that Paul is talking about here, and escape from under the judicial wrath of God, you've really got to want to change. You see, it was because we repudiated that faith relationship with God in the first place that we got ourselves in this mess. We rebelled against God. We're part of a rebel world. And the reason some of us resist Christianity is because deep down we want to stay rebels. We don't want to change. Call me a cynic if you like, but I'll tell you one of the main reasons young people in the university here don't turn to Jesus Christ has got nothing to do with intellectual doubts and everything to do with their sexual behavior. They don't want to change. They don't want a patronizing, moralizing deity invading their private lives and telling them what to do. It's the sin of Adam. Recapitulated again, again, again. There is a way out. But the key is faith. You've got to trust this God. Trust his word. Trust him when he says no, even when you don't understand why he's saying no. Trust him because in Jesus Christ, he has called you to himself and made a way whereby you can begin again with him, enjoying that faith relationship with him that you forfeited. This is the one thing, you know, that really matters above everything else. Some of you are first years. You're worried that your grant hasn't arrived yet. You're worried that lectures start soon, and goodness knows how you're going to cope with all these brilliant people you see crowding around you in the corridors. You worry about the boyfriend or the girlfriend you left behind and whether they're going to still be yours at the end of term. You worry about how you're going to do without mum and dad. Though you'd hate to say you were homesick, you still cry into your pillow a little bit. I tell you, this is a far more important issue than all those things that are pressing themselves on your mind right now. Am I a believer? Do I walk with God by faith? Because if I don't, I walk under his wrath with the rest of a rebel world. Let's pray together.